This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 78 was recorded on August 31st, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to our many listeners in the great state of Texas. Please know that our hopes and thoughts are with you and your families as you cope in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. Alhambra Partners CIO Jeff Snyder has been one of our most popular feature interview guests, but even finance professionals in our audience have told us that it's hard to fully appreciate everything Jeff has to say because his work assumes a great deal of familiarity with the Eurodollar system, something many people in finance don't fully understand. So when we sat down again with Jeff to tape a primer on Eurodollars, it quickly evolved into several hours of absolutely fascinating content. Now, frankly, I personally had no idea how much there is to learn and understand about the history of Eurodollars, and particularly the functioning of the wholesale Eurodollar system and its impact on money creation in financial markets. I learned a lot from taping this series of interviews with Jeff Snyder, and I know you're going to really enjoy them. Because Jeff gave us so much material, we were forced to break up what we're now calling Eurodollar University into a four-part series. So we're going to air part one as today's feature interview, and we'll be airing the remaining three parts later this year. Eventually, the entire four-part Eurodollar University series will be available in its own special section of the MacroVoices.com website, similar to my five-part Accredited Investor Academy series, which is already available free of charge at MacroVoices.com. Be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview with Jeff Snyder, as Patrick and I will be back in our postgame segment to reflect on what we each took away from part one and to share a glimpse of what's coming in the rest of the series with you.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's take a look at the S&P 500 here. The S&P has just blasted off to the upside, and the NASDAQ even has been a bit of a leadership in that role as well. And the S&P 500 is pretty much almost back up to its highs. It's interesting because obviously we had this huge bearish tone a week or two ago when Jeffrey Gundlach announced that he had this big position in S&P puts. And suddenly everyone was piling on the short trade based on this idea that September was going to be uber bearish. And yet here we are seeing the shorts getting the squeeze. It will be interesting to see whether this follows through to the upside with a new breakout to all-time new highs. What's your feeling about the S&P 500?
Well, Patrick, obviously you have to ask yourself, how is it possible that we could be rallying to almost all-time highs on the back of an ICBM launch, or I guess it was just a mid-range ballistic missile launch across the top of Japan? And make no mistake, that was a threat to show Japan that they could have targeted and dropped a nuclear warhead anywhere they wanted to in that country. The fourth largest U.S. city is underwater, government shutdown potentially looming. How is it possible that these things could all be bullish for the stock market? And I do have a theory, and believe it or not, it actually makes some sense to me, as crazy as it sounds. And my theory is this, Patrick. I think this is all about Hurricane Harvey, and specifically what the market has really been worried about. You see a lot of fear and a lot of hype in the system, but what's the real concern? I think it's the possibility of a showdown over the debt ceiling leading to a technical default where the U.S. misses a bond payment, a treasury bond payment. Now, if you want to know what's the Lehman-sized catalyst that could really kick off a crash, that would be it. I think the market was worried about that, and I think that it's actually Hurricane Harvey, which is in a very ironic way bullish. And the reason it's bullish, I think, is that for the politicians in Washington that would like to have a showdown with President Trump and force a government shutdown and potentially a default on a debt payment, trying to make President Trump look bad. How do you pull that off when he's boots on the ground in Texas? Can you imagine him standing there and saying to a bunch of people, I'm here with you people who need me doing my job, and those people in Washington, the politicians, the swamp. They're trying to shut the government down when you need it the most. And I'm here to help you in the hurricane. Politically, very, very difficult to take on the president when we're going through a national crisis. So I think that is my theory, at least, as to what has been behind this rally. Now, in fairness, when I come up with a theory, I also have to look to disprove my own theory. One thing I will say is if I look at the spread between the September and October T-bills, and that would be one would potentially default and one wouldn't in the event of some kind of showdown and missed bond payment, that spread is not telling me that there's no risk there. It says that there's still risk there. So that potentially goes to disprove my theory. But frankly, you know, if you don't believe my theory, what else are you going to come up with to explain a bullish stock market on the back of, you know, ballistic missile launches directly over the top of Japan? That's all I can come up with. So again, I think that what we need to look at is how does the political environment shape up, and does the climate come around to where there could still be a showdown with the president over the debt ceiling, or are we in a climate where it's going to be difficult for that to happen? The scenario that I'm watching most carefully, though, Patrick, is if this situation with Harvey and this next storm, Irma, could potentially, if it hits us in the same way, be even worse. If these natural disasters were to create an environment where it's impossible to challenge the president on the debt ceiling increase and we get through with a clean increase, I could easily see the market moving to all-time highs and substantially higher. Now, no, it doesn't make any sense to me on a fundamental valuation level. If that happens, I'll be looking to start accumulating puts, because I think that before the year is out, it'll move back to the downside. But, you know, late stage bull markets never make sense. And I think that if there is a scenario that propels this market dramatically higher, it would be an early resolution to the debt ceiling where there's an all clear signal there and we have nothing to worry about. With that off the table, I think the market could actually move a lot higher, even though I don't think it makes sense on a fundamental basis.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index because it's been a really interesting week. We started off at the Monday and Tuesday with a breakdown of those July lows. It really looked like the dollar index was just downdrafting, and then immediately we get this sharp reversal, almost undoing all of this selling from the start of the week, putting the dollar index more or less flat on the week. It's really interesting because this is an important kind of line in the sand. This is the area where obviously Raoul Paul and Julian Brigden were looking at. And it's going to be a real tell whether the dollar index can hold this level. What's your feeling here?
Well, I have to say, it looks to me like Juliette de Klerk really called it. What she told us is we could expect a bounce up. We got that to 94. She said short it. She said it was going lower than the previous 92.50 or 92.35, whatever the previous low was. And sure enough, we broke down to a 91 handle. That really opens the door all the way down to 87, because after 92 didn't hold. And you could say it was a false breakdown. It didn't last very long. But, you know, it looks like we're headed lower still. We're back down from 93 to a 92 handle this afternoon. So I think that it is looking kind of weak, and the bounce we've seen before. My philosophy, though, is when I know that I'm wrong, and I've clearly been wrong here. Remember, I was the guy who said secular bull structure in this market. I look for who's getting it right, and who's really getting it best is Juliette de Klerk. Her target has been 125 to 130 for the euro against the dollar. I'm going to be watching to see when we hit that target. And if that happens right around an 87 on the dollar index, which I think is entirely possible, that would be a long-term uptrend line. Maybe that's the buying opportunity that we've been looking for in the dollar index. But I think what we really need, Patrick, you know, we've been looking for this buying opportunity. When do you buy the dip? That's based on the assumption that this bullish argument structurally on the dollar index really is right. What if Raoul Paul and Julian Brigden and yours truly all have it wrong? So we really need to get some serious secular dollar bulls on the program to inform us on their thinking. Patrick has been hard at work at that. Starting next week, we're going to have a dollar bear to really present another view, and we're going to work on getting a couple more in coming weeks. So we're on the case. Stay tuned.
All right, Eric, let's move on to crude oil. Now, crude oil found some interesting supports around this $46 level on the downside, and we see this nice big reversal back up. We're trading right now just above 47. What's your take here on where crude oil is going?
Well, I agree with you. I think this is a technical reversal. The 45.58 low print was to the penny the 61.8 retrace of the previous upswing. So it was time for some kind of a bounce. The sudden move at 10 a.m. this morning, got several tweets today from people saying, explain in the market wrap what the heck happened at 10 a.m. I really don't think that anything in particular happened to explain that 10 a.m. move, other than this market was ready to move back up. As you say, there had been some selling exhaustion at that Fibonacci level at 45.58, and it was targeting back above 47, maybe as high as 48. So I think that that's what was driving it. Now, what did come out around 10 a.m. was the news of the SPR release, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve release of another 500,000 barrels. That should have been bearish. So why the heck would that be bullish? The only reason I can think of that that news could have been interpreted in a bullish context is maybe people were expecting an outright sale. This was not a sale from the SPR. This was a swap, meaning that the refinery that got that 500,000 barrels has to pay it back at some point. So the oil that's coming into the market will eventually go back off of the market. Definitely does not explain the size of the move we saw at 10 a.m. Frankly, I don't have a good explanation for the size of the move that we had at 10 a.m. So let's come back to how did we get down to 45.58 from 48 in the first place. I was surprised by how many traders and media people who should have known better seemed to be so surprised and exasperated by this move down in West Texas Intermediate crude. Now, again, I guess they're not listening to Macro Voices because, as we explained last week, the reason Harvey was bearish for crude oil, when a storm comes into the Gulf and takes crude oil production offline, that's definitely bullish. And this was bullish in that sense. But when the storm then causes damage to refineries, taking refining capacity offline, that's bearish. So the question you have to ask is, well, which one is bigger? Now, you could measure that in terms of number of barrels per day taken offline in both supply and in demand. But I think it's actually more complex than that. It's really more about timing, which is when that supply is going to come back online. We're already down from a high of 429,000 barrels taken offline by Harvey to, as of Thursday afternoon, only 236,000. On the other hand, on the refining standpoint, although some of the refineries have restarted, the ones that were not badly damaged, the biggest refinery in the country looks like it's going to be offline for at least a couple of weeks. And frankly, I don't think they've done a full damage assessment to really know that. They're not saying it's going to be back online then. They're saying at least a couple of weeks. So it's important to understand that you don't really know whether this is bullish or bearish until you know how long the refineries that were taken offline are going to stay offline, and we don't really know that. So expect a lot of chop in the market as we try to figure out what exactly is going to happen. Before I move on to this week's inventory, I want to explain why I think it's irrelevant. I had a few people trolling me on Twitter about this when I said it was irrelevant. Look, last week, yes, it was before the storm, but it was not unaffected, as so many people are saying, by the storm. People knew the storm was coming, and that affects decisions. Ships that are able to rush into port in order to try to beat the storm. Exports that are planning to leave port delay their departures, and they don't sail because they don't want to depart into a hurricane. We also, although most of this was before the storm, during the course of Thursday evening and Friday, we were starting to close in refineries as well as the port itself. So it did have an effect on last week's numbers. More importantly, next week's numbers are going to be even more affected because on the one hand, you know, let's suppose that you get no imports coming in this entire week and there's a great big huge, you know, 15 million barrel drawdown in next week's inventory. Well, you've already got 20 million barrels of crude floating around in the Gulf of Mexico waiting to get into port. So what I'm really trying to emphasize here, folks, is inventory numbers are meaningful in a steady state system where everything else is in balance. What we have now is everything else out of balance. So I really don't think it matters that much. But if you want the numbers, crude drawing down 5.4 million barrels this week, Cushing, Oklahoma, building 689,000 barrels, gasoline, building 35,000 barrels. De minimis build, but a build just the same. Don't expect one next week, folks. Distillates building 748,000 barrels. U.S. production pretty much flat at 9.53 million barrels. So again, next week's inventory is not going to have any particular relevance because there's so many ships waiting to get into port. There's exports waiting to get out. Obviously, the production is going to be way off next week, but we don't know how long it's going to stay off. Also coming up, we're coming into what's called fall maintenance season. Now, that word maintenance is a little bit misleading. It sounds like fixing things that are broken. Normally, fall maintenance is not about fixing things that are broken. It's about retooling the refinery to produce winter grades of gasoline rather than summer grades of gasoline because there's a slight chemical difference there. Well, trust me, folks, this time around, this season, there will be broken stuff to fix during maintenance season. That means the maintenance is more elaborate than usual. All of our historical norms are thrown off. So our ability to measure what's going on by how seasonal norms relate to current data is really put into question. So I don't think the next several weeks' worth of inventory numbers will have anything close to the usual relevance that they do. But you can be sure traders will be reacting to them and trading them. So I would expect a lot of volatility in this market in coming weeks. We don't know yet what the full effect of Harvey will be on production and refining capacity. It's clear that gasoline prices are skyrocketing to the upside. No surprise there because we're not sure if we have enough functioning refineries to supply the nation's need with gasoline. The physical traders are doing everything they can to try to divert international shipments of gasoline back into the United States in order to supplement supplies. So let's bring this down to the bottom line. What's the direction of crude oil prices going to be from here? I think it's going to depend on more than any other factor on how long the refining capacity that is taken offline stays offline in contrast to how long the production capacity that's taken offline stays offline. Looks to me like the production capacity is coming back online very quickly. The refining capacity isn't. That means I'm bearish on crude oil. But, you know, these details are moving very quickly. Things could change in a minute. So you've got to continue to watch the data very carefully. And finally, if you haven't heard it yet, don't take your eye off the weather because Hurricane Irma is already a Cat 2 hurricane. Now, Category 2 hurricane doesn't sound that big because this last one was Category 4, so it's only half as big. But hang on, this is the first storm in the last 7 years to build to Category 2 strength east of 35 West, which is basically a line in the sand in the middle of the ocean. From a weather standpoint, that what drives the strength of these hurricanes is the amount of time that they spend with the eye of the storm over warm ocean water. That storm has changed and recurved a little bit further south, which means warmer water. It's moving slowly, which means more time to build more energy. Particularly watch if it ends up going south of first Puerto Rico, then Hispaniola, and then Cuba. If it stays south of those three major landmasses and over water for all that time, look out. We could really be in trouble. So if you imagine that scenario where we had both Hurricane Katrina and Rita within a month of each other, we could be looking at the same thing again. I'm not predicting that. Don't put those words into my mouth. But it's a distinct possibility, and we all need to be watching the weather.
All right. Well, Eric, let's move on to gold because we have now 4 consecutive days trading above 1300 on gold. It really feels like a breakout. You know, even a couple day pullback and just in good technical order, the buyers bought the dip. Now, obviously, anything can change over any new news from North Korea or something like that. But at least from my perspective over here, it looks like we've got a breakout. What's your feeling here?
I could not agree more, but I think there's a caveat we have to stress. First of all, let's just review, as you said, strong breakout this time. You know, we had a false breakout we reported a week ago. This was a real breakout all the way up to 1331 from the previous resistance line around 1297. As we see very frequently in technical analysis, the price drifted down to almost retest that same line, actually got down to 1202 or so this morning, and then it's right back up to the upside. The real test will be breaking above 1332. The market may already be there by the time listeners listen to this podcast because we're only about $3 short of it. This chart looks fantastically bullish to me. Now, caveat, what got us above 1300? Clearly, U.S. dollar weakness. What got us all the way up to 1330? Clearly, North Korea missile fired over Japan. So if you think that this U.S. dollar downtrend is secular in nature, and you think that this North Korea situation could escalate further from here, you're already late to the trade. Buy gold and buy it fast before it gets away from you, because I think it's going much higher if those things are true. But consider that we had the Ralph Paul and Julian Brigden argument, which is every dollar rally, major dollar rally, has always had a midpoint breakdown of about 10%. That's about where we are. Looks like we could be coming up on a support level. If this dollar bottoms and reverses to the upside, and North Korea blows over and de-escalates, that would be the scenario under which I think this could turn into a big false breakout. Now, those are some pretty big ifs. All told, I like the chart here. I think it looks bullish. But if you want to know what to watch out for in a long gold trade, it's the scenario of the dollar reversing and the geopolitical tensions blowing over.
All right. Well, let's move on to that 10-year treasury yield. And what a breakdown. I mean, we're trading at the 212 level right now. What's your feeling here on interest rates?
Well, you know, the move from 219 last week down to 212 is only 7 basis points. It's not a great big move unto itself. But, Patrick, that happened as the stock market was rallying dramatically. So to see bond prices moving up, and of course, that's what happens when we get lower yields, at the same time as stocks moving up, that really tells me that this is not just a normal ebb and flow between one market into the other. This is a trend that's underway. And 212 is exactly the support level in yields that's been the trading range for a few months now, it seems. So if we break 212 for lower yields, I think it's going to be a pretty fast trip to 2%. Next target after that is 180, and we're very much on the way to that lower yield scenario that Ralph Paul talked about. On the other hand, you know, we're right at the resistance level. You got to wait for the breakout to happen before you are convinced of it. So 212 is the critical level. We're right on that resistance line. I think we said this once before. I said, boy, I think it's going lower. And we were right at 212 or 213. And sure enough, it bounced all the way back up to 227 or so. So we could be wrong, but we'll see what happens. I've got a feeling we're headed lower in yield.
Thanks for the market wrap, Eric. Now, for this week's featured interview, we're airing part one of our Eurodollar University series with Alhambra Partners CIO Jeffrey Snyder. Eric's interview with Jeffrey is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Today's feature interview with Alhambra Partners CIO Jeffrey Snyder was pre-recorded back in July of 2017 as part one of our Eurodollar University project. There's a slide deck to accompany this interview, and we recommend that you download it before listening, as we'll be referring to the charts and graphs that it contains throughout this program. Registered users at macrovoices.com will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, go to www.macrovoices.com and look for instructions to register and get the download next to Jeffrey Snyder's photo on our homepage. This four-part series came about after listeners to the Macro Voices weekly podcast asked for more in-depth coverage of the Eurodollar system. We'd interviewed Jeffrey Snyder from Alhambra Partners several times, and each time, Jeffrey had myriad fascinating observations about the signals that he was seeing in the Eurodollar futures market, which enabled him to both make observations and predictions about what was occurring in the global economy. Our listeners loved Jeff's interviews, but even the finance professionals in our audience told us they needed a primer on the Eurodollar system, its origins, and its history in order to be able to better appreciate and understand Jeffrey's insights about what the Eurodollar market is telling us about today's economy. So we decided to do a full hour-long show just focusing on the history and structure of the Eurodollar system. But before we knew it, that turned into a four-part series. This is the first installment in that series. So without further ado, joining me now is Alhambra Partners CIO, Jeffrey Snyder. Jeff, thanks so much for coming back and doing this Eurodollar University with us. Let's go ahead and look at your slide deck, starting, I guess, with slide 3. How does a dollar become a dollar? What's on your mind here?
Well, first of all, thanks, Eric and Patrick, for having me back and giving me the opportunity to explain this. one of the most common questions I get is to go into a deeper, whether explanation or even just a detail of how these things actually work. You know, the things that we're talking about is modern money supply and modern money in general. It's a global system that, quite frankly, nobody seems to have much of a handle on because it's been languishing in orthodox economics for decades now. And really, a lot of it takes place in the shadows, far away from where we can actually directly observe what is going on in the monetary system. So, you know, an opportunity to actually explain some of the intricacies and the arcane nature of the way these things actually work is a tremendous opportunity for me. And I think it'll help a lot of people get a better understanding of how we got to where we are and why we're stuck in this state.
So how does a dollar become a dollar? What is the origin of money, I think, is where you're starting here.
Well, the thing, it's a long journey, and it doesn't start, you know, there's no particular start date, there's no particular end date. It's essentially a qualitative evolution that has taken place over many decades. You know, we talk about the Eurodollar, and the Eurodollar is sort of a loose term here, but the Eurodollar itself started out sometime in the 1950s. We actually have no idea where they came from. It's just by the 1960s, there was this thing called the Eurodollar, and it was an offshore market for dollars. And as technology changed, as the way banking system behaved changed, the monetary system globally evolved with it so that the Eurodollar was sort of at its basis. And it has become so much more than just offshore deposits of dollars. It's become essentially what is more like a computer network where it's just a system of standards and protocols that allow global banks to conduct financial and monetary business with each other. And so that's why I kind of put it a dollar in quotation marks, because it's evolved from what was, you know, a recognizable dollar, you know, a piece of paper that's stamped with the Federal Reserve paraphernalia on it, to what is now a virtual currency that where there's almost no currency at all, certainly no money, because, you know, the gold system has been fully dismantled. But the dollar as it is today, this Eurodollar system, is for money people unrecognizable as a dollar. And so that's why it's a quotation mark, put quotation marks around it. And it's a very long history that presents a lot of challenges for analysis and understanding.
And just to put this in context for our listeners, the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944 at the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, was where the U.S. dollar became the world's reserve currency. And there was an agreement by treaty to essentially settle all international trade in U.S. dollars. That means if people have agreed around the world to settle their trade in U.S. dollars, they've got to have U.S. dollars. So by the 1950s, this market had been established to effectively have U.S. dollars outside the United States. Presumably that began with the purpose of settling international trade, but then the U.S. Treasury became the de facto favored reserve asset for central banks to hold as reserves. Now all of a sudden the whole world has to be able to have U.S. dollars. And so it seems like this market really that you're describing evolving in the 50s kind of came out of necessity, but although the Bretton Woods Conference contemplated this decision that the dollar would be the reserve currency, there was really no plan for how everybody was going to get their dollars, and it just sort of evolved through the banking system. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're right, Eric. And in fact, there was actually a precursor market to Eurodollars called bankers' acceptances. And the acceptance, a banker's acceptance is an instrument that goes a long way back. And again, you're right. The purpose of the acceptance market is to mediate financially global trade needs because, you know, a firm in Japan that's doing business with a company in Sweden has to be able to translate one currency into another. And it's not as easy as just, you know, going down to the local store and picking up Swedish kronor so that you can buy something from Sweden. You have to have an ability to mediate between what are essentially very different and often very distinct systems. And so the first iteration of a solution, or at least a more elegant solution to global trade in monetary terms, was something called banker's acceptances. Now, an acceptance was a fully liquid instrument. There was a market for these things that was provided and made stable by central bank intervention. In fact, one of the first tasks of the Federal Reserve when it was founded in 1913 was to establish an acceptance market for U.S. dollars. And throughout most of the early history of the Fed, we're talking about the 1910s and the 1920s, Most of the seasonal variation in the Fed's balance sheet came from buying and selling, you know, increasing or decreasing their holding of bankers' acceptances, all in the name of marrying money supply domestically with the need for money offshore in global trade.
So let me interrupt you there, Jeff, because I want to make sure that we've defined our terminology before we go on. The definition of a euro dollar is basically any U.S. dollar that's on deposit in a bank outside the United States. And the name euro dollar comes from the fact that originally it was primarily in London and other European markets where people were depositing these U.S. dollars. These days, we've got U.S. dollars on deposit in Shanghai, China, or Thailand, or any place else. They're still called euro dollars just by convention, but it means any U.S. dollar, a dollar issued by the United States that is on deposit in a bank outside of the U.S. banking system. Now, Jeff, you just said that bankers' acceptances played a role in the evolution of this euro-dollar system. So referring to slide 6 in your slide deck here, please explain the role that bankers' acceptances played in this euro-dollar system as it began to evolve.
Sure. And the bankers' acceptance market was essentially an interbank market. It wasn't a place where a lot of people, individuals or firms, traded acceptances back and forth. And its role was primarily to mediate between different currency systems and to use the major currencies of the day, or what we would call today reserve currencies, which in the early 1900s was either pound sterling or, as the Federal Reserve increased the dollar acceptance market, U.S. dollars. And so it was a way for global trade to take place such that, you know, smaller systems wouldn't have to hold large deposits of, say, you know, Japan would not have to hold large deposits of Swedish krona to allow for Japanese firms to trade with Sweden, because obviously the Swedish don't need yen and the Japanese don't have a lot of krona available. So what they would do is use an acceptance market to either buy yen for sterling or yen for dollars and then use the dollars or sterling to translate them into krona. It was an interbank method to allow for the trade of goods efficiently, or at least efficiently as possible at the time. And one of the most important parts about that is that these bankers' acceptances were bearer instruments that had deposits attached to them initially. In other words, you had to deposit currency in either dollars or sterling in order for a bank to write an acceptance. And a good way to think about it is something like a cashier's check. In other words, you have to present the funds ahead of time in order for an acceptance to come into existence. And from there, it could be traded back and forth. But these acceptances were instruments that were fully reserved up front. And that's an important distinction in how the Eurodollar market evolved from it, because having the deposits required at the front of it was one way of introducing inefficiency in what was attempting to be an efficient solution.
Okay, so in the Bretton Woods Conference, it was agreed that U.S. dollars would be used to settle international trade. Then, of course, it would not be practical if you're buying a whole bunch of stuff from, you know, Sweden is selling things to Japan, to actually send, you know, large suitcases full of dollar bills back and forth on a ship between Sweden and Japan is not a very good way to settle trade. So they come up with a system where essentially the guy in Sweden is saying, let me take some of my kroner, use that in order to buy a bunch of U.S. dollars, essentially a cashier's check that's worth 10,000 U.S. dollars. I'm going to give that to my trading partner in Japan, or vice versa, depending on which way the trade is occurring. And that acceptance is essentially the way that we're translating from local currencies into not physical U.S. dollars in a suitcase, but what's essentially a cashier's check that's issued by a bank that is redeemable for U.S. dollars. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, it's a derivative interbank instrument that allows these things to happen, and again, as efficiently as possible, because it's very cumbersome, as you point out. Put a suitcase full of cash onto a ship and hope it arrives, you know, or even further back where they would use gold, where gold bullion would have to move between locations in what was usually a dangerous process. And so there was always a search for a solution that allowed these things to happen, to allow global trade to happen, but to do so in a method that wasn't so cumbersome and inelegant.
Okay, so I've got it on the role of bank acceptances. In those days, we didn't have the concept of people in Japan having a U.S. dollar-denominated bank account that they could store U.S. dollars in, but we had bankers' acceptances denominated in U.S. dollars that could be used to facilitate international trade, and each of the trading partners could eventually buy or sell those acceptances on an international market in order to get back to their own native currency. Now, how did we get from there to a market for euro dollars where there's actually dollars on deposit outside of the United States in banks other than U.S. banks?
Well, it's, you know, that again, we get back to the genesis of the euro dollar market, and to this day, we really aren't clear about what exactly happened. Now, one of the stories about the euro dollar's creation was that there was a vibrant sterling trade, because obviously with Bretton Woods, pound sterling was a co-reserve currency with the U.S. dollar. And the Great Britain was a dominion over, you know, a huge swath of the global geography. So therefore, you know, a lot of global trade was conducted in sterling. But in the mid-1950s, we went through a couple sterling crises. And then, there was a Suez crisis where it became a little bit more difficult to actually transact in sterling for these types of global trade type arrangements. And so because the dollar was a co-reserve currency, and at that time there was a store of dollars in various places for whatever reason. I mean, some of the stories say that the Soviet Union was placing dollars in banks in Switzerland to avoid any political ramifications, conffiscation from U.S. authorities. But for whatever reason, there was a ready supply of U.S. dollars on deposit outside the U.S. so that when the sterling went into crisis in the 1950s, these merchant banks in Britain didn't have to break a stride. They simply switched, for whatever reasons or for however they did it, they simply switched from using sterling acceptances to euro dollars. And what a euro dollar meant was that, unlike an acceptance, they didn't need to be deposits of cash up front for these things to work. In other words, they could just be derivative claims on derivative claim. And so that was an even more elegant solution, more efficient solution to what is, again, a cumbersome problem. So the euro dollars, in effect, started to supplant the banker's acceptance market. Not that the acceptance market ever went away. In fact, it had somewhat of a revival in the 1970s. But by and large, there was this market for dollars outside the U.S. that filled the need for, at first, global trade.
So now what we've done is we've essentially gotten to the point where in the banking system, in the global banking system beyond the United States, the concept of a certificate of deposit, a CD denominated in U.S. dollars, is something that's not only available in the U.S. banking system, but that's also available in the Japanese banking system, in the Swedish banking system, in the Chinese banking system, and so forth. So that if you have essentially the ability to trade certificates of deposit in a bank anywhere in the world that are denominated in dollars, you can trade that CD for a bunch of, you know, Japanese motor parts or whatever it is that you're importing from another country. Is that correct?
That's largely it. It's the ability to mediate trade needs using what is essentially a global standard. That's why we call it a global reserve currency, because it allows these various systems, these very distinct monetary systems and trade systems, to translate one from the other. And that's what the dollar's role was in terms of the global trade network, was to allow these things to happen in a way that was as efficient as possible so that we could, you know, efficient trade means better economic growth.
Okay, Jeff. So we were just looking at slide 7 in the deck, and you're describing how euro dollars are providing this system. But wait a minute, where did the euro dollars come from? How did they come into existence? Please help us understand that.
Yeah, and that's a point of contention that goes back a long way in its history. Milton Friedman, if you go to slide 9, Milton Friedman wrote it was republished in 1971. I'm not really sure when he originally wrote the article, but he wrote what was a very good starting point to understanding the euro dollar market and where these euro dollars came from. And essentially, you know, he started out with an example of where he was at a talk of these prominent business leaders and bankers. And this whoever was speaking was asked the question, where do euro dollars come from? And he gave an answer that Friedman basically said was complete nonsense. And I think it highlights the difficulties people have with these the concepts of the Eurodollar market and these offshore currency markets is that we don't really have any good basis of knowledge for where they come from. We can understand pretty intuitively why they exist. You know, that's what we just discussed with the evolution from acceptances to Eurodollars. We know why they exist because there's a need to translate global trade on like terms. But where do the Eurodollars actually come from? And that's kind of one of the things officials and monetary authorities throughout the 1960s. You know, if you go back in the FOMC meetings in the decade of the 1960s, in 1960 and the 17 FOMC meetings that took place that year, which produced 941 pages of discussion, the Eurodollar wasn't mentioned a single time. The following year, 1961, there was a lot of talk about short-term capital outflows and you know, what became Triffin's paradox or Triffin's dilemma. The Eurodollar was mentioned exactly once that entire year. In 1962, for example, the Eurodollar was mentioned 15 times. So, you know, the Eurodollar started to make an impact in monetary policy so that by December 1968, the FOMC was talking about the Eurodollar 28 times in just that one monthly meeting. And by, you know, April 1969, they had mentioned the Eurodollar 62 times. There was an evolution taking place in the market as well as an evolution in official understanding of what actually was happening out there in this offshore marketplace for dollars. And there was a great deal of confusion, especially in the late 60s and early 70s, about what was actually going on, because this was, in a lot of ways, a radical transformation of monetary behavior. It was a bank-centric system that was evolving outside of all of these official definitions and official statistics, and even official understanding. So what Friedman's point was that there was a great deal of confusion about the Eurodollar because largely nobody really knew what was going on.
Well, that begs a question, Jeff, because in those days under the gold standard, stock analysts tend to look for macro cues more than anything else from the U.S. federal government's official data on the money supply. Now, the money supply as it was measured then was the U.S. banking system's money supply. So it sounds like you're saying there was actually this global money supply of U.S. dollars that nobody completely understood at the time, even though it was probably very, very important. Is that right?
That's correct. And you know, part of not understanding what it is means you don't know how many euro dollars are out there. And so it was a source of great consternation, officially and otherwise, about what was going on, especially in these London dollar markets where, you know, interest rate differentials played a big role, as well as, you know, factors beyond just global trade, where banks were shifting liabilities all throughout, you know, the world in dollar terms. And as Friedman pointed out in his 1971 article, the source of these euro dollars were not actual physical currency, but the bookkeeper's pen. In other words, these were, like I said earlier, these were interbank markets of ledger balances. They were just transactions between banks that didn't actually have suitcases of cash, nor did it have an instrument, a bearer instrument like a banker's acceptance. It was simply bank liabilities traded back and forth. And one of the things that Friedman provided in his article was several examples of ways that we can understand how these Eurodollars came into existence and how that market grew, and even the effects of it on the domestic money supply.
So as you've highlighted on slide 9 here, there was an official that supposedly had said where euro dollars came from, balance of payments and dollar reserves of non-U.S. central banks, proceeds of euro dollar bonds. And Friedman was outspoken in saying that that answer was complete nonsense. So obviously that begs the question of what's not nonsense, what's the right answer? And you're getting into that on slide 10. Please explain.
Yeah, and I think Friedman's point was, you know, this was not somebody who was a layman. This was somebody who was, you know, a high official of international financial organization, somebody who ran probably a global bank. And it was global banks operating this market. And here was this official of a global bank who was giving what Friedman called a nonsense answer, essentially highlighting the difficulty with even people within the system understanding where it was these euro dollars actually came from. And his answer that I give on slide 10 is that the source of euro dollars is the bookkeeper's pen, which is, again, the interbank market of traded bank liabilities. And if we start on slide 11, Friedman was kind enough to illustrate several examples of how he believed Eurodollar deposits actually became Eurodollar deposits and what the effects of those were on the domestic and global supply of dollars.
Now, hang on a second, Jeff, because the whole supposed benefit of the gold standard, when we still had a gold standard before 1971, when President Nixon took us off of that standard, the whole idea was you can't create dollars out of thin air. There has to be a physical piece of gold backing every single dollar in the system, and that connection to gold is what basically assures that the dollar's value doesn't get inflated away through money printing, what we now call quantitative easing and what central bankers these days think is a good idea. So it seems like you're saying before we even came off the gold standard, we were conjuring U.S. dollars out of thin air through fancy accounting tricks. Is that right?
That's correct. The Bretton Woods system, in my mind, actually defaulted in 1960, not 1971. And one of the reasons for it was this weakness that was contemplated all the way back at the Bretton Woods meeting in 1944. The gold exchange system was created with this inherent weakness in it, where actually central banks could circumvent all of the protocols that were supposed to keep U.S. dollars and pound sterling into a specific value range. And in fact, the history of the euro dollar market in the 1960s is one where central banks were actually inactively using especially swap transactions to do that. In other words, they were undermining the Bretton Woods system themselves through the Eurodollar market and the use of Eurodollars as a way to accomplish, you know, domestic monetary policy, because central bankers have never wanted to be constrained by gold going back to the early days of the system. So, you know, you're correct, Eric. There was supposed to be a gold backing to this, to the dollar system and the sterling system in particular. But even by the middle 1950s, that was increasingly not the case.
So this is sort of like Bill Clinton saying he never violated the drug laws of the United States. We've got these rules set up that U.S. dollars in the U.S. banking system have to be backed by gold. Let's go get stoned in Europe, basically. Let's go and conjure a bunch of money out of thin air. And as long as we call these deposits euro dollars and keep them outside the U.S. banking system, we can circumvent all of the protections that were designed in Bretton Woods to try to assure the gold convertibility and the true value of the dollar. Is it really that extreme, or am I exaggerating to say that?
I think it, in one sense, it's that extreme, but there's also this other sense where confusion reigned. You know, so nobody had an idea exactly how it worked. They also had no idea how big it was. So I think that's, you know, one of the reasons why they fell into Triffin's paradox, was the idea that there was something going on outside the U.S. and we don't really know what it is. Therefore, we're going to kind of be concerned about it, but we don't know if it's a violation of, you know, the Bretton Woods standard or not, because we don't really know what it is. And it took a long time for people to start to come to terms with actually what was happening. And that was one of the reasons why Friedman was asked to write this article, was because, again, there was so much confusion about this Eurodollar system that by 1969, at least, had become enormous. I mean, in today's dollars, $30 billion sounds like nothing. But that's just $30 billion in 1969 dollars that they knew of. And so they had a sense even then that there was something big going on outside the U.S., this offshore dollar market, even if they weren't really sure what it was. And Friedman's contention was, as you alluded to, Eric, that these were dollars that were conjured out of thin air. In fact, it was a money multiplier system in parallel to the domestic system.
I want to walk through the math on slide 11 and understand what's going on. But before we go there, since you mentioned Triffin's paradox, Robert Triffin was a very prominent economist in this same time frame in the 1960s, and he wrote about this paradox that had to do with the U.S. and its role as the issuer of the world's reserve currency. Please explain for our listeners who may not be familiar a summary of Triffin's paradox and what that means before we move on to the going through the details of slide 11 here.
Well, what Robert Triffin was talking about was essentially the, and he called it a paradox because it's two competing tensions that were created by the Bretton Woods system. In other words, the Federal Reserve and U.S. monetary authorities had to be responsible so that it would maintain the gold exchange standard. Yet, but because the dollar was the global reserve currency, any rise in global trade had to be met by a rise in money supply of dollars on in these offshore markets. And so there was a natural tension between supplying dollars for rising global trade and the ability of the United States to back those dollars by its gold reserves. And so he called it a paradox because the two were set in opposition to each other.
So essentially, the U.S. dollar was chosen as the world's reserve currency because the U.S. was the strongest credit in the world. And what does having reserve currency status do for the United States? Basically gives it a free license to borrow and spend beyond belief without suffering the consequences that a nation that's not the reserve currency issuer would normally face, and hence the paradox. I want to come back now, though, to the math on slide 11, and let's just walk through this. What was going on all the way back in the 1960s when the world is supposedly on a gold standard, where a dollar is supposed to be guaranteed to be redeemable for a certain amount of gold? And you're basically showing here how European deposits of dollars are being created that are not backed by anything.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm using Milton Friedman's example from 1971. And what he said in his narrative, he imagined an oil sheik from a Middle Eastern country who decided that he could get a better dollar rate on his CD in a London account, what Friedman called Bank H of London. The sheik started out with his $1 million at Morgan Guarantee, and he used Morgan Guarantee as the example because that's where he was giving his speech at the time. So what happened in the dynamics between how that sheik's money transferred from New York City and Morgan Guarantee and Bank H of London? And what Friedman said was that assuming that Bank H also has a dollar deposit account at Morgan Guarantee as well, the $1 million check goes from the sheik's account in New York City to the new sheik's account at Bank H in London. Now, Bank H in London now has $1 million credit in deposits, and it also has, keeping with what was thought to be prudent liquidity practice of a 10% reserve, it now had $900,000 in free cash that it could put to use someplace else. And so, and what Friedman further hypothesized was that the UK, that the Bank H in the UK would lend it to what he called UK Limited to engage in trade with some US firms about, whatever kind of trade transactions they might engage in. And so what happened on that is UK Limited, which is his corporate example of the firm doing the trade, is given a check drawn from Bank H's Morgan Guarantee account. So the net result in terms of domestic money is zero. So even though $1 million from the sheik's account goes outside the U.S. into London, it comes back in the form of this trade in dollars, this $900,000 check and trade in dollars to UK Limited, plus the $100,000 that remains on deposit with Morgan Guarantee as part of their reserve requirement and liquidity reserve. Now, while the net supply of U.S. dollars is not changed, now the world supply of U.S. dollars has increased by $900,000. That is the $1 million of the sheik's deposit that goes to Bank H in London minus the $100,000 reserve that remains at Morgan Guarantee on behalf of Bank H. So in other words, the U.S. money supply doesn't change at all, while the global dollar supply increases by 900,000.
And if we take all of these similar transactions to this in aggregate, the global supply of U.S. dollars increased to the tune of like $30 billion, which was a huge, huge amount of money at the time. And not only does that defeat the intended purpose of the Bretton Woods system, which was to keep the U.S. dollar as essentially being as good as gold, but it does it in a way that probably very, very, very few people at the time, and only a few more today, even were able to understand what was happening. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, we also have to remember one of the chief reasons for this to start taking place as much as it did was that U.S. banks were constrained in what interest rate they could pay out to depositors by Regulation Q. And so there was no such constraint in London or Zurich or Montreal or Tokyo that would all offer dollar deposits at a rate that was much more competitive than what domestic banks could offer. And so for, that's, I think, one of the reasons why Milton Friedman used the oil sheik in his example was that anybody who was a global agent or a global firm that had dollar deposits had no preference for keeping them in either New York City Bank or a London Eurodollar Bank. they only cared about essentially, or for the most part, what interest rates they could obtain. And the best interest rates could be obtained outside the U.S. because of regulations inside of it. Friedman's point was this was a fractional reserve system taking place outside of a fractional reserve system.
So that covers the example on slide 11. What is being described here on slide 12? It looks like you're showing effectively how this can grow as more and more transactions accrue. What is the net result of this in terms of the supply of dollars to the world? And I'm sure that it basically undermines the gold standard. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, and what Friedman suggested here was that we have essentially a money multiplier system in euro dollars that was in parallel to the money multiplier system in domestic dollars. And what he theorized here in his first example, taking it to the second example, was that Bank H in London still lent the money to UK Limited, but instead of making a dollar loan to a U.S. domestic firm, they instead bought some Russian timber. And so they now the Russian firm had dollars that it deposited at Bank R in London, assuming Bank R also maintained the same 10% reserve requirement or liquidity reserve, that they essentially this process would continue to repeat until it reduced down to the lowest possible number based on that 10% reserve requirement. And if you follow with all of those essentially follow-on transactions, what you get was, again, no change in the calculated money supply of the United States, but outside of the U.S., the total change in dollar supply available to the world is an increase of $9 million. What Friedman's point was essentially was that entire $9 million was all drawn from a single check drawn on Morgan Guarantee. In other words, there was the deposit basis for this Eurodollar system was in many ways unknown to these other counterparty transactions. In other words, as these euro dollars got multiplied further and further away from the original transactions, they were all based on the original transaction, which was the Sheikh moving $1 million to London from Morgan Guarantee. And so again, to your point, Eric, these are dollars conjured out of thin air through a multiplication process.
So these examples that we've seen on slides 11 and 12, Jeff, what you're showing me is that Morgan Guarantee transfers $1 million to Bank H of London, and Bank H of London does all kinds of tricks, and before you know it, there's 9 million more U.S. dollars in the global money supply than there was before, thanks to one guy with just $1 million. I know how bankers think, though. I've got to believe the Morgan Guarantee guys are not going to want Bank H of London to have that business. They probably want to figure out how to keep the business in-house so that they can be the ones to multiply this money and defeat the intended purpose of the Bretton Woods system. It looks to me like slide 13 is where you're going to tell me that's exactly what they do.
And you're absolutely right. That's exactly what they did do. And it was easy enough for these U.S.-based banks to set up subsidiaries in London or Zurich or wherever outside the U.S. in order to capture or to maintain these deposit liabilities, but do so outside of the U.S. domestic system. And what Friedman went through was another example where he hypothesized a New York bank and its London subsidiary, where instead of a $1 million check going back and forth, we now have a $10 million CD coming due at Morgan Guarantee, but that the Sheikh doesn't want to renew it because of the better rates in London due to Regulation Q. So what happens in this situation is that Morgan in London acquires the time deposit at its London subsidiary, being credited $10 million only in a bookkeeping transaction with its New York City parent. Now, on a consolidated basis, nothing happens because it's money moving from a New York parent office to its London subsidiary, and then the $10 million being borrowed back from London. So from the point of view or the perspective of both Morgan Guarantee and the U.S. monetary system, nothing changes. However, that $10 million is now out there in London, which provides a better rate for Morgan Guarantee's customer, the oil sheik. But in moving the CD and transferring the liability to its London subsidiary, the New York City head office now books, instead of a deposit account, a borrowed account. In other words, they're borrowing $10 million from their London subsidiary that's providing them a euro-dollar financing conduit. Now, they get a couple different benefits from doing so, because back then, reserve requirements were a big deal, and a lending transaction or an interbank loan transaction between the London subsidiary and the parent office was free from reserve requirements. So in Friedman's example, Morgan Guaranty would save about $600,000 in reserve requirements by switching essentially to from a CD to an interbank loan. And so we see the potential for transformation from a depository-based money multiplier system to a short-run or short-term borrowing-based interbank system where dollars can be moved back and forth between offshore and onshore to both avoid regulatory consequences but also to do things that they couldn't do under the domestic regulatory constraints. So it was the idea where banks could use the Eurodollar system as a way to enhance all of the things that banks want to do, which is to increase their balance sheets and to cheapen their funding rates and to make it much more efficient for however they want to operate.
And of course, all of this happens, Jeff, without any suitcases full of dollars moving across the ocean. The whole thing happens in accounting tricks on a ledger someplace. Tell us where you're headed with slide 14, where you say that not a single Federal Reserve note moves anywhere. Everything happens in interbank liabilities. What are some of the ramifications and consequences of that?
Yeah, it gets back to what Milton Friedman was saying about that the true source of euro dollars was a bookkeeper's pen. Which means that these are ledger balances that banks use to trade back and forth between each other that used to be done by either bankers' acceptances or, as you've alluded to constantly, the suitcases of cash or even gold bullion. In other words, we've moved from a system of that's based on deposits toward one that's more of an interbank liability system where what's all that's traded is a bunch of numbers on a computer screen. Even back in those days, where they did a lot of transactions through telephone wires and things like that, it was essentially a ledger system where we're getting away from actual deposits of dollars to an interbank traded system of whatever liability each counterparty would accept. And so one of the things we have to be aware of is that the word Eurodollar, as I said before, is not a technically precise term. At least the way I use it is not a technically precise term. I use it as a catch-all to describe what is essentially radical monetary evolution away from the traditional format that was based on deposits of dollars toward the more indescribable and ill-defined interbank market of these bookkeeper's pen ledger balances moving back and forth. And so the wholesale part of it is just as important as the offshore part of it. I think we want to describe a little more detail what we mean by wholesale finance.
And I see that the next several slides in your deck dive into the details of the wholesale aspect of the Eurodollar system. But since that's a change of topic, I think this is an excellent place to wrap up this first interview in our four-part series. We'll dive into the wholesale aspects of the Eurodollar system in part two. But before we close this first part of the series, I'd like to review the key points that I took away from this part of our conversation. The story begins in 1944, when the U.S. dollar was chosen to serve as the world's reserve currency at the Bretton Woods Conference. Because this meant that the dollar would be used for all international trade settlement around the world, all the other nations around the globe needed dollars in order to transact international commerce. By the 1950s, an offshore market for U.S. dollars had been developed in the form of bankers' acceptances. Effectively, a banker's acceptance was like a money order or cashier's check payable in dollars. These dollar-denominated IOUs were the first incarnation of the Eurodollar market. By the 1960s, there was a full-fledged Eurodollar market operating entirely outside of the U.S. banking system and therefore without U.S. regulation. But the Federal Reserve didn't even gain awareness of what was going on in the Eurodollar market until about 1962, when the phrase Eurodollar starts to appear regularly in FOMC minutes. Through the 1960s, the Eurodollar system created new U.S. dollar money supply out of thin air at the stroke of a bookkeeper's pen, with no backing by gold or by physical cash issued by the U.S. Treasury. All of this happened in the 1960s, when the U.S. was still on the Bretton Woods gold standard system. In a series of articles, Milton Friedman demonstrated how the Eurodollar system had created $30 billion of new U.S. dollar money supply out of thin air, without gold or physical cash backing. because all of this was happening outside the U.S. banking system, it was exempt from regulation that would have otherwise prevented it from occurring inside the U.S. banking system. Not wanting to be left out of the profits that were being made by offshore banks, the major U.S. banks established European subsidiaries so that they too could participate in this opportunity to conjure money out of thin air without gold backing. And the key point to remember is that through all of this, the new money was being created at the stroke of a bookkeeper's pen somewhere in Europe. There was never an ounce of gold required to back the $30 billion of new money supply that was created during the 1960s, and it was all exempt from oversight or even awareness of U.S. regulators. In part two of our Eurodollar University series, Jeff and I will dive into the wholesale aspects of the Eurodollar system. And if you thought the information in this interview was shocking in terms of how little U.S. regulators knew about what was going on at the time, you're going to want to put your seatbelt on for what you're going to learn in part two. Before we close, though, let's just give our listeners a quick rundown on what you do at Alhambra Investment Partners.
Well, I basically focus on dollars and euro dollars. Alhambra Investment Partners is an investment advisory firm, a registered IRA. And what we do is try to make sense of the world so that we can invest intelligently and prudently. And unfortunately, in trying to do that in the last 10 years, and even longer before that, has been incredibly difficult because, as I hope your listeners have appreciated through the presentation here, the world doesn't look like it the way it's supposed to look. And so there's a lot more to this story that is very much relevant to 2017. Somebody once said that you can't know the future without studying the past. And I believe that wholeheartedly, and I think, at least I hope, that what we've done here will help people understand that as well.
And we'll have to end part one there in the interest of time. Be sure to tune in for part two in this series, where Jeff and I will dive into the wholesale aspects of the Eurodollar system in full detail. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great start to the four-part series of the Eurodollar University with Jeffrey Snyder. This series really reinforces my view that the currency and money markets are truly three-dimensional, where there is an entire exogenous money market independent of the U.S. banking system. So what stood out for you in the interview?
Well, it was very interesting for me to learn the history going back to bankers' acceptances. I wasn't aware about Milton Friedman doing so much work on this during the 60s. I would have thought, given Friedman's prominence as an economist, that if he was the guy who was, you know, kind of ringing the warning bell, that it would have gotten more attention and caused a bigger fuss than it did. But the part that really spoke to me is the way that we tend to put central bankers on a pedestal as if they are the all-knowing ones who are so much better equipped than us mere mortals to know how to direct the global economy. Look, this story so clearly demonstrates that central bankers of the day literally had no clue about the enormity and the profound impact of the offshore Eurodollar system. Milton Friedman understood it, but the central bankers of the day had no clue how it worked, and the U.S. regulators didn't even realize that all of this money supply was being created offshore, completely out of regulators' view and control. And it's not a case of, you know, they knew about it, but they couldn't do anything for legal reasons. They didn't even know it was there. Now, frankly, I knew a lot of this already. I learned a lot from this one. But what really blew my mind was when Jeff got into the history of the wholesale Eurodollar system, starting in part two, beyond what we heard in this series. I had no clue, Patrick, how extensive or how much influence the Eurodollar system has actually had on so many things, from the 1990s growth boom that I thought I understood the macro drivers for, to contributing to the housing bubble. level. There are so many ways that the wholesale Eurodollar system that Jeff is going to explain in parts 2, 3, and 4 really explains major events that have happened in the last 20 years in a way that I never understood before. So I don't want to put too much of a spoiler out there. Put your seatbelts on, folks. Parts 2, 3, and 4 are going to be awesome.
Okay, since you already spilled the beans that you think that the real meat of the series comes in the later parts, which we're not airing today, that kind of leaves our listeners hanging. So how about you share a quick overview of what they can expect in the remaining parts of the series and why you think it's so important?
Well, Jeff gets into this whole wholesale Eurodollar market, which has to do with U.S. banks being able to create a huge amount of money supply without central bankers really even understanding what was happening. Jeff takes us through the history of the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s with a blow-by-blow history of what happened and when. And as he tells these stories about things happening, like Solomon Brothers bidding up treasury paper to just unexplainable levels, and nobody could figure out what was going on, and then he explains it was all about they needed collateral, because once they had that on-the-run treasury collateral, they could suddenly borrow money against it, not once, but 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times, because they had figured out how to rehypothecate the same collateral for multiple loans in the Eurodollar system. And Jeff goes into all the details of how this works and what the mechanisms are. Suddenly, all these things became clear to me. Why the 90s growth was so strong, if you look at Jeff's history of what was happening with the growth of Eurodollars. Well, how is it possible? You know, I could never believe, because it was so obvious to me in the early 2000s that we were in a housing bubble. You'd listen to these guys on the radio saying, you know, we'll get you financed no matter what. Bankruptcy is no problem. You're a deadbeat, no problem. You know, who was stupid enough to buy these mortgage-backed securities, not seeing the default risk? And what I gained from the rest of the series is a totally different understanding, Patrick. It's not that they were so stupid as they didn't understand the default risk. They didn't care. They knew, because of certain technical provisions of the Basel Banking Accords, that those mortgage-backed securities qualified for special consideration that allowed them to add leverage to their balance sheets, and they didn't care that they were obviously going to fall apart. So it's just an amazing story. And what this is probably a stretch, but the analogy I'm going to make, if you go back almost 100 years ago to the 1920s, two very, very famous scientists, Max Planck and Niels Bohr, basically published work that turned the whole scientific community upside down, because scientists looked at this stuff, particularly what Bohr did, and they said, okay, look, only two possibilities exist here. Either these Planck and Bohr guys are a couple of crackpots that don't know what they're talking about, or the entire foundation of the classical physics system, which is the basis of our understanding of the universe, is at best very badly informed and possibly completely wrong. So that can't be the case. So the whole scientific community dove on top of this stuff, tried to disprove it, and said, oh shit, they're right. That means classical physics doesn't work. The universe doesn't work the way we've always thought it did. This changes everything. And my experience with this Eurodollar University, honestly, Patrick, was the analogy here is basically, I think, Snyder is the Niels Bohr character in this story. If you go back to something like Ron Paul and Julian Brigden talking about the U.S. dollar and why they think a rally is set to resume, obviously, Ron and Julian are expressing their own personal opinions, but those are personal opinions that are informed by a common understanding in macroeconomics, in the study of macroeconomics, about what the forces are that drive the value of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. If you listen to this full Eurodollar University, you're going to have this aha moment where you're going to say, wait a minute, one of two things has to be true. Either Snyder's a crackpot and he doesn't know what he's talking about, or the entire system of understanding that we have, and it's not so much the value of the dollar, it's really about the supply of money, how money is created, and how the money supply contracts and expands. Our understanding of it is badly informed, if not outright wrong. And it was really striking to me. So that's the analogy that hit me. I know that's probably on the far-fetched side, but I think you're going to really enjoy the rest of the series, folks.
All right, Eric, as we approach the end of the show here, is there anything else you wanted to add before we close?
Well, of course, we're coming into Labor Day weekend, Patrick, and that means that we have some really big names coming up because we're going into our fall lineup that I know you've been working on for the last several weeks. So we've got a big dollar bear who was recommended and requested by several of our listeners next week. We've got quite a few really big names in the industry coming up. So be sure to stay tuned in coming weeks for some really fantastic shows. We still do need your help promoting the show. Please forward your research roundup emails, tell your friends and colleagues, retweet us. A retweet is always better than a like on Twitter. Use the donate button on our homepage if you can in order to donate to help us to defray our operating costs. We really appreciate those $100 donations that are still coming in. Use our player embed to put a Macro Voices player on your own website. And most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit these really fantastic guests that we're starting to get on the program. Benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest free stuff that we could find every week. This week, of course, you're getting the download for Jeff Snyder's presentation, as well as a bunch of other stuff. Patrick, tell them what else is in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find, obviously, the transcript for the part one of this Eurodollar University, which I'm sure that many of our listeners are eager to review. And there's also the link to the slide deck that accompanies the interview, so you can follow along some of the graphs that Jeffrey has put together. To stay with Jeffrey Snyder, we've also included a link to a number of his recent articles, including his two-part article series titled Not All Swaps Are Created Equal. There's also a link to a great interview with Ann Stevenson Yang titled China is Going to Hit a Wall. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.